Hey folks, the Other People Podcast is a listener-supported program. If you like this program and you want to support it, you can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. This show's entirely free. All 500 and something episodes? More than 500 episodes. They're all free. There's an official Other People app. That's free too. Everything's free. So I count on the support of listeners to keep the thing going. If you would like to show some support, you can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod. All right. Thanks.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jinx, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You looked like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person and just
hey,
one
everybody,
time.
How's it going? Right. Welcome right. to the Other People Podcast. I'm Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles, California. It's good to be with you. I'm very happy to have Liska Jacobs on the program today. Her debut novel is called Catalina. It is available now from MCD FSG. I think I said that right. It's the new imprint from FSG. It's called MCD. And it's a good imprint. I feel like they're doing interesting things. They're publishing interesting books, Catalina being prominent among them. So Liska Jacobs coming up in just a moment, just a few minutes. I want to talk to you first, though, about the fact that we got a dog. I feel like I need to share that news. It was it's a little puppy. We named her Twiggy, or my daughter named her Twiggy. And she was, it was like a litter of 11 puppies. The mother is like just a street mutt from like Mexico, Baja. She had 11 puppies. 35-pound dog had 11 puppies. I think they were born in Mexico, and then the mother and the puppies were found. They were starving. They were brought to this rescue that is in San Diego, and I wound up seeing the pictures of the litter on the internet. It was this big process. I don't know if you guys have ever rescued a dog before, but you know, in Los Angeles anyway, or in Southern California, puppies go really fast. It's actually competitive. And for me, it was a little bit stressful because we wanted a dog with a short coat. We wanted, I don't want to deal with a ton of shedding. Like a little bit of shedding, fine, it's a dog, but I don't want to have hair everywhere. And we also didn't want to get a huge dog, but when you're rescuing, you often don't know what the mix is. Like maybe, in our case, we knew the mother was only 35 pounds. You can sort of eyeball the puppies and make a guess, but we have no idea who the father was. Like, was the father a bull mastiff? Was it a trained killer from the streets of Mexico? I have no idea. So you're sort of rolling the dice. It's a little bit nerve-wracking. And then on top of that, it's competitive for these puppies. They go up on the internet. They show up on these like rescue apps. I had like four of these apps going on my phone, constantly checking to see if new puppies have become available. And then you find one you like, or you find a litter that you like. You go to the website. You have to fill out an application. The application has to be approved. You have to do a phone interview. You wait for them to notify you when there's going to be an adoption event where this litter is going to be present. You get on a special list to have a special meeting with the litter. But then you got to get there. And what I found having gone through a bunch of different rescues and like having visited multiple rescues, because I was very thorough about this process. I wanted to make the right decision. I wanted to get a dog that worked. I didn't want to get a puppy and then have to like return it or like feel like I fucked it up. Do you know what I'm saying? I wanted to come through for my kids. I also just didn't want to add too much chaos or headaches to our lives for the next like 12 to 15 years. So, I wanted to feel like I would have proper evaluation. And the problem with these rescues is that they're usually driven by volunteers. Like it's all volunteers. They show up on weekends, bless them, and they try to help these dogs find homes, but they don't really know a lot about the dogs. They can't really tell you with any confidence what kind of temperament, nothing like that. And then on top of that, it's usually like, they set up these kennels, they're stacked on top of one another, they're packed with dogs, all the dogs are barking, it's loud, and you're trying to make evaluations and decisions that are going to affect the next like 12 to 15 years of your life. So I said to myself, you know, with regard to this litter down in San Diego, like, I got to get there early. I got to have time. I got to get first in line. I want to make sure that I have at least a moment to evaluate the full litter and make a pick, try to find a dog that's, you know, a puppy that seems calm. Because that's what we wanted. We wanted a puppy, but like the calmest possible puppy. Sweet, gentle, not super hyper. So I got up at like 5 in the morning on Saturday, drove down there, was the first person there by a pretty good margin. Though there were other people who had a similar idea. And that's what I mean by competitive. Like, everyone sort of wants their little puppy, and they've fallen in love with a certain like member of the litter. And so the person who was second in line, it was a family, were standing there, like, you know, just outside of the adoption tent, like holding our place in line. And the woman's like, which one do you want? And I was like, well, I don't know. She's like, well, we want this one. And it had like Doberman-ish coloring, like markings. And I was like, okay, well, I can't promise you that I'm not going to pick it. Like, I didn't say that, but you could just sense that she's like, if you pick it, I'll claw your eyes out. That's our dog. It was that kind of thing. So I got first. And then, you know, once they open up the event, I go in and like everyone just starts crowding around this litter of puppies. They're in kind of this like wire pen, you know, all playing with one another and jumping over one another. And if you can imagine it, it is encircled by humans, mostly adults. Everyone's looking down at these puppies. Everyone's asking to hold them. And I've got this ticket. It says number one, but that doesn't really mean much. And the woman next to me, who is like the foster mom for these puppies, I'm like, well, which ones are, do you think have the best temperament out of the females? And she sort of like shrugged and was like, I think the brown ones, you know, the two caramel girls. And then I'm holding different puppies, you know, like there's five, I think there were six females and five males. So I'm holding six different females. And the foster mother, like this woman who had fostered these puppies, she sort of leans in and she's like, just so you know, you're like, I know you're number one in line, but like, it's really a free for all. Like, if you don't pick in the next 5 minutes, it's just, they're just going to start going. So now the clock is ticking and I'm like, oh shit, I got to make a decision. This is it. This is the moment of truth. Am I going to get this puppy? Which one am I going to pick? Which one is the right one? And I held, you know, the puppies. I held some of them twice. There was a black and white one that I really loved and I held it and I looked it in the eye and I was like, are you the one? And then I picked up this little caramel girl who was sort of the runt of the litter, if not the runt, then close to the runt, but very sweet and just very still and calm. Looked me in the eye, and I looked at the woman, and I was like, I'll take this one. And that was it. And next thing I know, I'm like filling out some more paperwork, and I'm paying. You know, you make a donation or whatever to the rescue, and then they give me the puppy, and they scan the microchip in the puppy, and I'm getting my picture taken next to a sign, and then I'm in my car, and I've got this puppy in my lap, and I go home. I'm texting my wife. I'm taking like selfies as I'm driving. And I'm like, you know, you got to get the kids ready. You know, we got to film this. And then I arrive at home, put the puppy on the porch, ring the doorbell. We're filming that whole thing. And it was actually very sweet, like watching my daughter's face. Like she was shocked and almost started crying. Like not even because, you know, she wasn't sad, but she was just like surprised. She didn't cry, but she almost did. And then my son, River, like hugged the dog. We have this video that's just crushing. He hugged it and put his head down on it and was like, I'm going to go night-night on the dog. You know, it's hard to describe, but it was very cute. So it was a good moment. And now we have a dog and her name is Twiggy. My daughter selected it. That was a whole process that I kind of micromanaged. But naming animals, naming anything to me is a very big responsibility. My daughter's only 7. So we had to manage that situation. We let her pick the name. But we basically did like a long list of names. And then my wife and I created a short list. And then from that short list, she got to pick. So she got to pick, but we just made sure that we culled it. We culled the list so that there would not be any names in there that I would spend the next like 12, 15 years of my life regretting having to say, you know, multiple times a day. So the dog is named Twiggy. My daughter wanted to name the dog like Peyton or Skylar. Which I think are like the names of characters on Disney shows. See, this is why you micromanage the naming process because, you know, nothing against the name Peyton or Skylar, but that's not the name of this dog. It doesn't fit the dog. When I hear those names, I'm thinking of like, you know, a sorority girl or something. getting sick at like a party. Someone's holding her ponytail. Do you know what I'm saying? Or holding her hair back. That's all I can think of. But it wasn't the right fit is what I'm trying to say. It wasn't right for the dog. But as a kind of compromise, the dog is officially named Twiggy Peyton Listy. And that's that. My guest today is Liska Jacobs. Her debut novel, Catalina, is available now from MCDFSG. It was a delight talking with her. She was just over here yesterday, and I'm very pleased to get to share this with you. So here she is. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Liska Jacobs.
It's interesting. I've had a few different people that have been surprised that there is an island right off the coast of Los Angeles, right on in the Santa Monica Bay. It's technically part of the Channel Islands, but it's the only one where it's, I guess, inhabitable. Like, there are a huge tourist trade there, lots of hotels.
How many people live out there?
Not a lot. I think full time there's like less than 1,000 people that live there. Okay. A lot of people commute, actually, which is really interesting, for days at a time to go work their jobs, and then they live over here.
I've lived in Los Angeles for 20 years. I've never been there.
Really?
Isn't that weird?
It's a really weird place. It's a very bizarre place, mostly because there's sort of two sides to it. This is why I set the book there. There is Avalon, which is the touristy side where, you know, it's very postcard California, Mediterranean, you know, it's very...
Even the name seems kind of creepy. Avalon.
Avalon, right?
Because it sort of evokes this sort of perfection or something.
Yes, yeah. Well, and it's very artificial, right? It's been built to be this playground, right? This little tourist destination. And then the other side of it is Two Harbors, and there's probably, I don't know, maybe 50 people live over there. There's one bar.
That's all you need.
Yeah, that's all you need, right?
Yeah.
And if you go and camp there, bison will come down into the campsite. There's like Catalina Island foxes, which are the size of cats. There's eagles. I mean, it's a very wild terrain. It's very much exactly how it was probably 200 years ago.
Which you really can't say for just about any place else in California.
No, right? Yeah. But that's why I liked Catalina, because I feel like Southern California and Los Angeles especially has that sort of duality, right? There is Hollywood and this artificial postcard version of Los Angeles, but then you have the Santa Monica Mountains right there, or you have the National Forest. So I wanted to...
Even Griffith Park, it's got the mountain lion.
Yeah, I saw a coyote there 2 days ago.
Did you?
Yeah, brought like 11 o'clock in the morning. He came out, looked at us, was like, "Whatever," trotted away.
You don't have a small dog for me to eat. So.
Yeah, he was very bored. He kind of looked us over, like, "Are you hiding one?"
Yeah, I'm out of here. They can be sort of brazen sometimes.
They can, huh? Do you have problems with them here?
Like, you see signs, like, in the neighborhood where there'll be someone, like, a coyote ate my cat, you know?
See, isn't that crazy? All the way in Larchmont, which is pretty, you know, central. We're not super close to the mountains, but they come down here.
Yeah.
It's very, you don't get that in New York.
No.
Right?
Well, I mean, you get, what is it? They have the hawk.
Falcons?
The falcons that live there.
Yeah,
but, and
which
maybe
is pretty cool.
In Central Park, I don't know what the wildlife situation is there.
They have a zoo.
But like in terms of wild animals, they don't have coyotes.
No, or mountain lions.
Mm-mm. Yeah, so there is this weird collision of nature and then artificiality. Like, this place really shouldn't be here.
Yes.
We're piping in all this water.
And we're piping in the dream too, right? It's on top of that.
Right. You know?
So it's not just a city. It's a place where we manufacture fantasy.
And it advertises itself to the world.
Yeah. And in Catalina, I wanted these characters who were sort of all from here in Southern California that have this artificiality about them. But there is, of course, a deeper, something darker underneath. And what happens when you put those two things in conflict.
Right.
So.
Well, it makes me think, too, of, did you see this news about Robert Wagner now being a person of interest in the Natalie?
I did, yes.
Because that story has always been, I've always associated it with Catalina Island.
Yeah.
I can't think of Natalie Wood and Robert Wagner and Christopher Walken.
Right?
And, you know.
In one of the coves out there on one of the sailboats.
Yeah.
It's a very, and that's what I think that's the perfect way to look at Catalina, right? It's this perfect, beautiful place where someone can die.
Yeah.
Right?
Was that in your head when you were conceiving of this?
I don't think so. Not really.
Or
not
maybe
until,
like, buried in your subconscious somewhere?
Probably buried in my subconscious. Because, you know, when you're born and raised here, those kind of stories linger in the back of your mind. I think that's part of the, I guess, where the noir comes from too, right? The Black Dahlia, stuff like that.
I was going to say Black Dahlia. There was like, wasn't there like a strangler? Like somebody who would crawl in your window?
The Hillside Strangler?
Was that guy in the 80s in LA?
Yeah, I think so. I think that was the 80s.
And
yeah.
Manson.
Manson and Simi Valley. Yeah, that's a huge one. I mean, and they capture not just our imagination, but I think the entire country, right? It inhabits a huge part of our self, like subconscious.
Yeah, well, because I think this place tries to represent itself as perfection, perfect mm-hmm. weather, beautiful mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. So when something like that goes on, it's like that much more striking and
yeah.
media friendly. And then mm-hmm. also you're just living in a media capital that can perpetuate
yeah.
those stories.
And, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh,
so, okay. So you did research, you went over there and camped.
Yeah. My, editor likes to joke that I'm a method writer. So every time I'm writing a second book too for MCD. And the first book I thought I want to set it somewhere that I can go and do research and stuff like that. But of course I was just a poor college student. So, I could afford going to Catalina, and luckily it worked out for the book. So that's where I went. And I went over there a few different times and camped and did both sides of the island. And
how do you camp? Like, you just show up and then you hike over the mountain and find a place?
No,
or you
can
drive?
You can take the boat. So the boat over can either drop you off in Avalon, or you stay on and it'll drop you off in Two Harbors.
And then you go up from Two Harbors and just...
Yeah, you just camp right. You can camp right. I mean, the boat drops you off and it's like maybe a 10-minute walk to the campsite with all your gear.
Okay.
You can also rent all your camping gear there. Really.
But then somebody else has used it.
Like, that's true. Yeah.
Who knows what went on.
Yeah.
In that,
it's
in that
really
tent.
Beautiful in Two Harbors though. It's wonderful. And one of the coolest things about Catalina is they have their own sort of unofficial cocktail, I guess.
What's it called?
Called Buffalo Milk. And you can't get it here, which is the weirdest thing because we're not that far away from Catalina. Like, if you were to walk into a bar and say, "Can I have a Buffalo Milk?" They'd be like, "What are you talking about?"
My wife calls white wine with ice cubes a Marina Del Rey.
Or Newport Beach.
Yeah, right. Same thing.
Yeah. It's, so it has no buffalo milk in it, of course, but it's mostly vodka. There's some nutmeg. It's blended with, actually, I don't want to tell you. I don't want to ruin the secret. I want everyone to go.
Is it something disgusting?
No, it's delicious.
Oh, okay, good.
And it's very easy drinking.
Okay.
It's a little bit frightening how easy it goes down.
You're like, I've had 14 of these.
Yeah, you finish one after a long day hiking or swimming or... you know, kayaking, you drink one down and you're like, I'll have another one. And then as you're drinking that one, the first one hits and you're like, wait, these all had alcohol in it?
Yeah.
It's like a boozy smoothie or shake or
perfect.
Something. It's very nice.
And you can kayak and do all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, they have kayaking gear. They have snorkeling gear to rent.
This sounds good.
It's wonderful.
Maybe I should go.
You really should. And then the sea life out there is incredible. You can see our state fish.
Which is?
The Garibaldi.
I should know that.
Right?
What's a Garibaldi? I don't even know what that is.
I think I said it. Yeah. He's a beautiful orange fish.
I did not know that. I didn't even know. I guess it makes sense that we would have a state fish. But how big is this thing?
He's, I don't know, like medium, small. Like they're really gorgeous.
Like a large potato? Kind
like
of?
Like a small football.
A small, large potato or a small football. One of the two.
Yeah.
Wow. And then dolphins.
Dolphins, of course, yeah. Sea lions, lots of sea lions.
Those things can be. The internet keeps giving me stories of sea lions like attacking people.
Yeah, they get a little bit rowdy, especially during spring when they're trying to.
And well, they're on the beach or like they're not exactly fast of foot or whatever.
Yeah.
You know,
well, the coves. The nice thing about Two Harbors is that they're all coves, so they're protected, and the sea lions don't really come into them. So it's mostly just, the kind of stuff you see when you're snorkeling.
Okay.
Which is really nice. Stingrays, stuff like that.
Did you, so you're camping, you're just kind of there to soak up the vibe?
Yeah.
Or is there something in particular that you were there to see or person you were there to interview or something? Or was it more just like a general, like, I need to get a feel.
And funny enough, when you do that, things happen that sort of play into the world you're already creating, which is really nice. And then they end up in the book, which is, I find that if you open yourself up to whatever world you're writing in, things happen that sort of help you along, like create the story.
I've had different conversations with people over the years about the importance of field research.
It's very important.
I've heard two different things. I've had people who like have set like award-winning books in Africa, never set foot in Africa.
Mm.
And I'm like, wow. And I'm like, how did you do that? And they're like, I just went on Google and like looked at pictures.
That's totally doable. It's doable. I think it depends. I mean, I hadn't been to New York in a decade and a half, and part of the book takes place in New York. And I was able to just, you know, use Google Maps, make sure some things were still the same. But I find there's some stuff that makes it easier for me to transport myself there.
And plus, like, just the fun of going on a trip.
Oh, yeah, totally.
As part of the creative process, like, right? Get out into the world, like, live a little. Like, don't, yeah. It's great to sit down and, you know, sit in front of the keyboard and do your work. But if you're going to set something somewhere, like, go travel, live a little.
Definitely. And I feel like, you know,
if you can,
somebody definitely, that's the other thing, right? Like, I could only afford going to Catalina.
Right.
You know,
what does it cost to get, from Los Angeles to Catalina? What's it running these days?
$60 round trip, I think. It's a little steep, but,
on a
you
boat.
Can go for free on your birthday. Actually.
No shit.
Yeah. So you just register on the website.
You get seasick?
No, not really.
It's not bumpy out there?
No, it's not too bad. The boats are better than they were like 20 years ago.
Because that's what I always think. I think that's my holdup is like, am I just going to get barfy on this boat?
No, there's one. It's like the Catalina Island Express, and it charges across the bay. You're there in like an hour and a half.
Oh.
It's not bad at all.
And the thing too, that it, like the thing, the lure of Catalina, like even just as like a symbol out there on the water, because I've looked at it a million times,
right?
Is that you're in this really crowded, like giant megalopolis.
Yes.
Millions and millions of people. You're constantly navigating this crush of humanity. And yet an hour and a half across the bay is this basically perfectly preserved island.
Yeah.
That's no different than it was 200 years ago. That's sparsely populated and like riddled with wildlife.
Yeah.
And I've never been there.
And isn't it funny to be here though, and to be stuck in this place, and every once in a while you catch a glimpse of it out there. Either it's in, you know, from the smog or the way the during sunset, you can see it and you know, it's there, and there's something comforting. And I feel like I always tell myself, I'll go there next weekend or next month, I'll plan a trip, and a year will go by and I'll realize it's just because I see it out there and I'm like, oh, I feel comforted that it's there. I don't really have to go and experience it again because, you know, I wrote a book that takes place there.
Yeah, like,
I know what it's like.
I've been there, done that. Have you done a reading on Catalina?
I haven't. And actually, I met some librarians that were so excited that I wrote a book that takes place there. Because they don't have any literature, I guess, that takes place on.
Well, now
the
island, they do.
Which is surprising.
But that's the other thing. As like, what a shrewd move as an author. Like, if you want to own a place territorially as a creative person, try writing a novel about a place that literally has no literature about it.
Right.
No competition
at
all.
It was very calculated on that front.
You're like Ross McDonald never did. What are the LA writers? It's like the famous noir writers. Raymond Chandler.
Yes.
And, you know,
they never went out to Catalina.
No.
Right.
No. They, you know,
which
didn't...
is funny because it was very popular place in the 50s and 40s for the sort of jet set. They'd go there. There's a giant what they call the casino. They had jazz shows and stuff like that.
Did you learn this stuff as a function of your research, like the history of the place?
Yeah.
When did it first sort of open its doors? Like, do you know the origin story of it in terms
of Catalina?
Yeah. As a place that's like, you know, a kind of an extension of LA and the basin or whatever.
I do know originally it was owned by, I think the Wrigley's brothers.
That's
the
right.
Wrigley's, right? And it was sort of a private island. And then
they used to have spring training out there.
Yes.
For like the Cubs.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I read that
and
once.
They did a lot of filming there, which is how they ended up with the bison out there. They flew over bison to film scenes for a film that I can't remember the title of now. And then they just left them there.
So there's just like buffaloes?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. I got to do this.
Yeah. It's really kind of a wild place, which is another... You know how we have the parakeets out here now, which aren't natural for here. And recently we started getting more peacocks in Pasadena also. So,
by the way, Pasadena is beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
What's the name of the big garden? I'm blanking on the name.
The Huntington.
Huntington Garden is, I just went there for the first time.
Really?
But pathetic. And I'm like, this is maybe like top three place in LA that I've ever been.
Yes.
I love
gorgeous,
it.
It's gorgeous, isn't it?
Oh,
it's
my
a
God.
Beautiful, beautiful. If you go into the Huntington on the right day and you start looking for houses to buy in Pasadena, you're like,
well, and there's all these beautiful old houses and it's sort of, there's a
old California money.
Right.
There.
And there's like an article in the paper recently about how it's becoming like sort of chic, like Pasadena, people are moving
I
out
know.
There.
I know. Every time my husband and I, we will move somewhere that's sort of on the fringe of.
And then it gets co-opted.
And then it gets co-opted and we get pushed out.
Where are you going to get? Pretty soon you're just going to be like, I'm in Nevada. I have no idea.
Yeah. I don't know how this happened. I'm in Mojave.
You guys want to go to the beach? It's going to take a while.
We can go tomorrow. Pack up tonight.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, you know, hopefully there's a little bit of time. It's just, it's hard to figure what's going to happen. Like at some point people are going to have to move out or how do you, like, you can't just keep growing.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I recently have had to make peace with it. Los Angeles becoming an international city, that it's not the city that I grew up with. It was always, I think, a place where people came to visit, but it wasn't a place where you would go hiking and hear other people on the trail speaking different languages.
Really?
Yeah, we went hiking yesterday in the Santa Monica Mountains and we heard German, we heard French. So it's just become a place where, and I think people are living here from other countries too. It's not like they're just coming here on vacation.
Oh, yeah.
I was reading some Eve Babbitt's. Do you know her?
Yeah.
Familiar with her?
I mean, I don't know her personally, but
no,
I'm familiar
with
her.
No one does, right? She's a recluse now, but I was reading an interview with her after they reissued Sex and Rage, and she was saying that she also had to make peace with Los Angeles being an international city. And I thought, well, if she has to do it, I guess I have to do it too.
Right.
It's sort of her town first. So
yeah,
if she can do it, I can also make peace with it.
And she's somewhere around here. Why haven't I should track her down?
She's still in Hollywood. Yes.
But she won't talk to anybody?
No, I don't think so. You know her story, right?
It's a fantastic story.
She was the original LA woman, right? That's the Doors song, right? She was one of his lover. She was sort of all over the place in the 70s and 60s.
The Marcel Duchamp picture,
where she's playing chess nude.
Right.
And she wrote a
series. I love how I remember
books.
That. I was like, yeah, I remember that.
And that's what she's famous for. She also did some album covers. She painted some album covers too. And then in the 90s, she had like a freak accident where she was smoking a cigarette, leaving a party, and it caught her skirt on fire.
Oh, shit.
And whatever material the skirt was made out of, it just went up.
Oh, God.
And she burned, I think, more than half her body.
Oh, God.
And they had to do some fundraising at the Chateau Marmont to raise funds for her surgeries. I think she, like, it was really scary. She was in ICU, and now she stopped writing and doesn't see anybody.
Oh, did it affect her appearance, like her facial?
I think so, yeah.
See, that's like tough, especially for somebody. I mean, it'd be tough for anybody, but especially somebody who's sort of known for their good looks. And,
oh, yeah.
You know.
If you read her writing, especially now that it's being reissued, a lot of her essays, especially there's a new one coming out from Counterpoint called Black Swans, and all the essays in there are still, she's in her 50s, but she's very much assured of her beautiful skin and her looks, and knowing what, you know, we know now that 5 years later, after that book comes out, she's burned. It's really kind of tragic.
Yeah. Well, and like, what do you make of, because we talk about the surface beauty of Los Angeles and you grew up here. So it's always been there. You know, you've always been navigating it. And there's the weather and there's the beautiful mountains and the ocean. And
beautiful people.
And then the beautiful people.
Yeah.
And it is really like, because it's something that, you know, I don't leave here that often.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in LA or Southern California pretty much all the time. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't get out into nature as much as I should, except for like hiking up in the mountains, you know, the canyons right here, which isn't nothing.
No, not at all.
But it's not the same as like being out in the sticks.
Yes.
And, like you'll just be on a hike and you'll like five of the most beautiful people you've ever seen. Like, like they would be like anywhere in the world. They'd be like, those are the most genetically perfect people you'd ever see. And they just walk past you.
Yeah.
You know, they're at the grocery store and you're just like, what the?
And then 15 minutes, five more beautiful people walk by and you're just, like, what?
Yeah. There's so many of them. And I guess like, what does that do to you?
You know, Catalina has a lot to do with beauty also, because I think I used to work at the Getty Center and I worked there for 5 years and I have this strange relationship with beauty because working in a museum, that's all you deal with, right? You're working in a beautiful place, but then you're also working with art, right?
Uh-huh.
And it creates a sort of isolation between you and whatever it is you're looking at, right? So the beautiful object is essentially alone all the time, right? So I think any woman, man, who feels the pressure that that we have here to be beautiful, also it feels a tremendous amount of loneliness too.
But I think, I get that. But I think like, if you are one of these, like, I was just at a party yesterday for the Super Bowl And I was talking to, we were talking about Jessica Biel. It was because Justin Timberlake was like the halftime show. And I saw her once and I was like, wow, like she is like got a glow. Like it was sort of like I didn't know what, I kind of froze and was like, she's freakishly beautiful in a town of freakishly beautiful people. Like, but like, I was like, and then we were talking about Tom Brady too, who's also freakishly beautiful. And I was like, Justin Timberlake is known as like a kind of a sexy guy and like good looking guy, charismatic, great dancer. You put him next to Tom Brady and like, he's like trash.
Because
Tom Brady's like, this, that was kind of the joke. It's like Tom Brady's good looks are so powerful that like even Justin Timberlake is ugly when you put him next to him. And then we were talking about Jessica Biel and how beautiful she is. And like someone was like either quoting an interview or had heard a story from a friend of a friend where like, she has a hard time getting roles because
of how gorgeous she
is. People are like, no one's going to believe that you're like a normal mom from the suburbs in this movie because like, you're just too,
beautiful. Too attractive.
You're too symmetrical. It's freaking everybody out. And I was like, she can really only play like the alien.
But see, that's what I mean. That's isolation right there.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So
it's a very strange, I think, thing that doesn't happen maybe in other cities. Right. Because also there's a competition here too with it. And the levels, maybe there's more at stake also, right? I mean, for
Power and money. Well, and it's like people who are that gorgeous, and then you add fame to it, which, you know, is a very weird thing. It's I always refer to it as like its own entity. So like if you're in the room with Jessica Biel, or if you're at like, you know, the grocery store and she's there, her fame is there too. It's like this invisible entity, but it's separate from her.
Yes.
And it's sort of, but it's also between the two of you. And so you have to sort of like try to like cut through that. And I would imagine that for somebody like her, even if she weren't famous because of her beauty, like what does the world reflect back at you when you have that?
Yeah.
And you walk into a store. I mean, I'm sure a lot of it is pleasant because people like to be around you. They're smiling. Like guys are fawning over you. But like, do people treat you like a human being, or do they treat you with like kid gloves, or do they, shy away from you because they're just like, ugh. That was my reaction.
Yeah, right.
I was like, you're so hot. I'm going to go
hide. I'm just going to pretend I don't see you. I'm a normal person. Yeah.
And then the irony too, like to go back to the grocery store example, is that when you're in LA, and I'm sure you've had this happen hundreds of times, you see somebody that you recognize and you're trying to be courteous. And so you sort of begin, and it's often an actor.
Yes.
But what it does, ironically, is it causes you to then start performing in the role of somebody who doesn't recognize Jessica Biel. Like, I have no idea who you are. I'm just going to squeeze this cantaloupe, like, you know, not to be Freudian, but like, I'm just going to stand here and massage this cantaloupe and not like understand who you are.
I don't see you. Yeah, right.
I've done that. Like Leonardo DiCaprio. One time I saw him and was like, I don't know. It was just so bizarre. I want to just be like, okay, dude, hi. Like, but you can't. Yeah.
Well, I grew up in sort of the film industry also. My father's a sound editor. His father was a sound editor. And and then his father also was a director. So I've been sort of on like the post-production side of the film world.
Like what kind of movies or shows do they work on? Anything we would know?
Oh, gosh, yeah. So he's worked on anything from, his first thing he was working on was 21 Jump Street.
Oh, wow.
And then he did a lot of, Robert Rodriguez movies.
Sure.
And let's see, he's worked on like 200 films.
Oh, okay.
Also, so like
go
lot,
through every one
of
them.
Stuff.
Let's start at the beginning. Bust out
lot,
the list.
A lot of stuff. And so I grew up on backlots out here.
Oh, okay.
But still, even then as a child, you feel their fame, what you're talking about, which is when you see an actor, there's something about their just vibe that they give off that, you know, oh, you're someone important and I'm going to pretend, you know, that I don't know that you're Antonio Banderas, you know, like, and even though I'm 12 years old and I know who he is,
right.
You know, I'm on a set and there he is.
Yeah.
There's just a different, I don't know, vibe out here about that kind of stuff. And I wonder, you know, it's funny because if, you know, we were in a coffee shop the other day and Mandy Moore walked in and nobody batted an eye. Nobody was like, everyone was just like casual, cool. And I thought, if we were in Iowa or somewhere, Minnesota, and would everyone have the same reaction? Or is it just a purely Los Angeles thing where we, all of us lesser Angelinos who are not actors, know better than to turn around and be like, oh my God, Mandy Moore.
I think there is, it's built into the thing here where you just have to sort of, you see, because it happens enough that like, A, you don't want to keep doing that.
Yes.
And B, it's like impolite, especially in a restaurant or something, to start like being like, can I get a selfie? Like, I don't understand. Or an autograph. Like, I can't do that. Like, I would never do that. But I think that there is a part. I mean, these people who are famous, they went into it because they want to be recognized.
Yeah.
So I think that part of them probably loves being in Iowa and having some like really cheerful like person be like, oh my God, I love
true.
You, you know?
Yeah.
And like out here, everyone's like, gotta be, you sort of have to be like too cool for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I also, you know, I cannot, as an adult, I can't go up to people and be like, oh my God.
Can I have your autograph?
No.
No.
This morning though, I should say, I was going for a walk and I had my little puppy Twiggy.
Aww.
And Michael Rapaport.
Yeah.
Who I see for some reason, like everywhere.
He was must live around here.
He was like, oh my God. Oh my God. And he's like, can I hold her? And I was like, yeah. And then I thought afterwards, I was like, I should have gotten the picture. I should have been like, dude, can I take a picture of you with my puppy?
Yes.
Like, I'm not going to be
perfect.
In it, but for her scrapbook, she needs to know that Michael Rapaport. Like,
she's got her own Instagram.
Yeah.
This is for that.
Twiggy. But he was like, so into it. He's like, oh,
Twiggy.
She's so beautiful. Oh, he's like the
aww.
Nicest guy.
Aww.
That's my Michael Rapaport impersonation, by the way. But yeah, no, it's a, you know, it's a fascinating thing. And I think that, there's something that, you know, it happens, I guess, if you're not from here, when you come here to live relatively soon after you get here or even to visit, I always call it like the demystification happened to me the first time I ever went to like the Walk of Fame and like Man's Chinese Theater.
God, how disappointing.
I was just
that
like, what a pit this
I
is.
I know. Every time I had friends come to visit me, then they'd be like, I know where I want to go. And I'd be like, please don't make me take you there.
Yeah.
And then I would, watch, cause I have to watch their disappointment.
You just watch the dream.
Yeah.
End.
Just watch it crush.
Yeah.
Just completely.
I guess like some guy in a bad Spider-Man costume like comes up and like tries to get into a photo.
Would you like to buy like a $5 plastic version of the Academy Award with your name on it? You know, it's very disappointing, except for Musso and Frank's, I will say.
That's, Musso, yeah, they're a little spots.
There's pockets in there, you know.
Yeah. But Hollywood's, you know, it's a bizarre place. And I guess you come here in, it's very loaded. And I was thinking too, like another thought that crossed my mind the other day is how powerful it is to see yourself. Oh, you know what it was? It was my last guest when I was talking to Debbie Graber, who was raised in the
I
Chicago.
Love her. Yeah. She's lovely.
Yeah, she is, right?
Yeah.
The Chicago suburb that John Hughes filmed a lot of his movies in. It was like the, you know, that whole milieu, and that's where she's from. And I thought to myself, like, holy shit. Like, think about how powerful that would be to be an adolescent and to see yourself reflected in like the hottest movie for young people in the world.
Yeah.
And it's your neighborhood. Like, I guess I sort of take it for granted as like a white bro from the Midwest and, you know, but just having you constantly kind of sort of see yourself reflected on the screen.
Yeah.
But to actually have it be your neighborhood.
Where you're from.
And to have that be the representative, like, neighborhood.
And did she say that he nailed it too? Because very rarely do you have people.
I mean, kind of. We were also sort of critical because I think some of the humor has not aged well in those films.
Yeah.
You know, it can get a little racist and, you know, I mean, it's
sexist,
a movie.
Sexist, yeah. There's not a lot of.
Yeah. I mean, you know, movies, you know.
It's very type, you know, like there's very typecast, you know. But there's something nostalgic about that in a weird way now, I guess, too, where we live in such a tire fire time that. You know, I'll take anything at this point.
Something with
I'll
like,
take a John Hughes film.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Chris Columbus did Adventures in Babysitting. That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
So weird. There's the girl who used to cut my hair, her boyfriend at the time, I think they broke up, but he was like the brother in that movie.
Oh, really?
And his grandfather, God, I'm going to forget who the actor was. But it was like the original child actor in Hollywood back like before the talkies or something.
Yeah.
There's all these weird lineages.
Uh-huh.
And then the girl who cut my hair, she was the granddaughter of Swifty Lazar.
Oh my God. Yeah. See, that's Hollywood
like,
for you.
Yeah.
Right.
She was like, you know, so you just have, you'd be like, what are you doing cutting hair? Like, why don't you, shouldn't you live in a palace? Didn't Swifty like leave you like a kingdom or something?
Yeah. So I used to do the events at the Last Bookstore and I did an event for Artie Shaw's son. And I can't remember his name now. One of his sons. While I was hosting the event for him, you know, setting up the chairs and introducing him, I wanted to be like, my great grandma dated your your father.
Yeah.
But you know, that means nothing now,
right.
You know, but like we all have these sort of weird,
you live here long enough.
You live here long enough.
And it happens. Like I had one of my friends, like, she's like, yeah, my grandma slept with Jim Morrison.
Oh yeah.
And I'm,
I feel like whose grandma didn't sleep with Jim Morrison at this
point? I was going to say, everyone's grandma slept with Jim Morrison. That's one of the things about Los Angeles that people who don't live here don't realize. We're all the one degree away from Jim Morrison. But yeah, no. And you were working, like you said it earlier, you were working at the Getty.
I was, yeah.
Which, like, visually, I want people to get a sense of it, because it's got some great little real estate. It's unique.
It's beautiful. It's you know, it's perched up off the 405, and it's sort of overlooking most of West Los Angeles. I think on a clear day you can see downtown also. So you can see probably all of LA. You can see Catalina too. And it's this beautiful, it's made out of travertine. It's Richard Meyer built it. Interesting, actually, not a lot of people know this, but that he built a bachelor pad on the site because he wanted to live on site while they're building the museum.
Oh,
so
wow.
There's this little mid-century sort of a apartment home, I guess, down on the hillside that you can't see from the museum. And there's a pool that's on the, it's sort of, he built it so that you can swim on outside and then swim into a tunnel and come out into the house. So, and this is where all the Getty staff used to throw parties. I went to a martini party there when I first started, and I was like, I'm never leaving. This is the best place to work.
Wow. That's great.
Isn't that cool? Yeah.
And the gardens at the Getty are beautiful.
The gardens are gorgeous too. Yes.
I mean, I've like, it's just a nice place to be. And like, there aren't the, one of the things about Los Angeles that bums me out is I don't feel like there are enough civic spaces that make you feel,
you're right,
with like lots of human traffic, and that make you feel like a sense of connectivity, the way that, like, if you're in Central Park or you're in like Bryant Park or, you know, other cities that are maybe smaller in terms of landmass and then also maybe organized a little bit more sensibly.
Yes. Than like Griffith Park, where it's just, you go up and then you go down.
Yeah.
Right? That's about it.
Well, that's why the Grove is such a big hit out here.
I know.
That's my theory on it, because it's like an outdoor shopping mall that's like kitschy and cheesy and looks like Disneyland.
Yeah.
But there's pedestrian traffic. People feel like they're in a city. They're like, oh,
yeah.
You know.
I do wish it was easier to get to the Getty. It's, you know, that's part of his thing. Richard Meyer's thing was that he wanted you to sort of journey to get to the art, right? So you take a tram to get up there.
Yep.
So you have to park, and parking's kind of expensive. So it's, you know, it's another one of those Los Angeles things where it's, and there's this artifice, right? It's been created to be this place. But it has its own sort of sordid history, and I mean, Getty himself, but also Richard Meyer. I didn't know him. I keep wanting to call him Richard, but we're not buddies. But he and, I can't remember his name, Robert Irwin. Is that who made the gardens? Anyways, they hated each other.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah. They were like, came to blows on the site quite frequently. In fact, that
no pool parties for them.
No, I'm telling you all the dirt about the Getty now.
Good. But, yeah, please.
You know, the fountain that runs, from the top. Of like the, when you first come out, there's this fountain and it sort of flows from the very top level down into the garden. Well, Meyer was the one that designed that fountain, and Irwin, who designed the garden, was like, I don't want that fountain running into my garden. I'm doing the garden. He's supposed to be doing the building. And Richard Meyer, I think there's sort of, I'm paraphrasing here, but at some point he referred to that fountain as him peeing on Irwin's garden.
Ladies and gentlemen, remember that on your visit to the Getty.
That's me doing my tour guide. I probably got their, you know, Irwin's name wrong. It might not even be who it was, but.
What were you doing there?
I was a library assistant in special collections at the Getty Research Institute.
All right. So what does that mean? Just like shelving books or?
No, it means, so the Getty Research Institute has its own special collections outside of the museum. So it's where researchers from around the world come and they look into, you know, whatever it is their specialty is. They come there and they look at, we have everything from Richard Meyer's notes and his blueprints and stuff to, we had Kirchner's sketchbooks there. You know, I mean, there's just a tremendous amount of material there. There's, I think, four floors, and one of them is entire vaults. It's seven different vaults. One's a frozen vault. So there's all kinds of stuff.
A frozen vault?
Mm-hmm.
Like below, it's like it's like a freezer.
Yeah, so anything that is, you know, perishable or film, stuff like that.
This is a sandwich that...
You had to put on parkas to get in there, too.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
it was really fun.
Wow.
It was a good time.
So, I was reading about you, and you were talking about Man Ray.
Yes.
And, like, his work. So why don't you talk about that? Because I think that's a fascinating story with regard to your decision to jump into writing this book.
Full time. Yeah. So I got the job at the Getty right out of my undergraduate degree. And I thought, this is the place where I want to be forever. I'm going to retire here. The people were wonderful. The pay wasn't great, but I was like, whatever, this place makes up for it. I'm around beautiful things and I'm in a beautiful place. And I think probably like maybe 2 years in, I started feeling just the reality of the place, which is just, you know, the grind, you know, the commute, driving up the 405.
Oh boy. Yeah.
It was 2008. So there was layoffs, which was hard. And that meant, you know, no one was going to be able to take any time off and everything sort of, we really just felt the crunch of the, just work. And I started feeling like maybe I wouldn't be able to write while I was working there, but I thought I'm going to try anyway. So I was taking,
so you wanted to write?
Yes. While I was there
in college, were you thinking of it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. I was taking writing classes at UCLA. So, while I was working at the Getty, I thought I will take some writing classes at UCLA Extension. The whole point of the Getty was it's a place that could inspire me and support me while I worked on short stories or wrote a book. But because it became a place that was so fraught, I guess, that it started taking a toll on me and my imagination. But even then, I still thought, it's okay. I can make this work. It's just a dark time for everybody. I'll work through this. And then one day...
Little did you know that 2017
was coming, right? I know. Now I look back at 2008 and I'm like, oh, those were the days.
But... the halcyon days of the Great Recession.
So sad.
Yeah.
So one day, Man Ray, a lot of people don't know this, but he spent time here in Los Angeles during World War II. He lived in Hollywood. And we have what is known at the Getty as the Hollywood Album. And it is a collection of all of his letters to his sister and different ephemera, his research and stuff. And I was assigned to rehouse it, which basically means that archiving some things, it means you have to put it in archival paper and make sure that it's going to withstand the next, you know, 50 years of being used. So while I was rehousing it, I was reading everything that I was putting into Mylar. And
Can I stop you there?
Yeah.
When you're putting in, like, you're archiving something, you're preserving it for the future, what is that process?
It's really kind of interesting, actually. So you have to, I'm still doing this as a career also, along with writing. The whole idea is that an artist has his artwork, right? But then there's all of his life's work, which is just his day-to-day emails, writings, journal entries, bills. And we put it basically in a series of, we put it in order for researchers to look at. So there, it goes into boxes. Those are numbered. Then it goes into folders. That's all sort of like level, you know, different levels of sorting it.
But what's the Mylar?
The Mylar is, an archival plastic. And so pocket.
It's like a pocket. And you slide the mm-hmm. paper in there. And just so that it can be like, doesn't.
Yeah. No one can ever take it out of there unless it's being digitized or something. But yeah, it's just something. So, you know, your fingers aren't touching it. It can't get ripped or anything like that.
Okay.
And it sounds so boring, but it's actually kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So that's all I was doing with his work. But I was doing it slowly so I could read everything, because the first, like within the first couple pages, I saw him writing a letter to his sister that said, "I hate photography."
That surprised me.
Yeah.
Cause that's what you know him for.
Right.
You know, yeah. These great photographs, but yeah. He hated it.
It blew my mind. I was like, what? So I photocopied it immediately before I put it in Mylar, and it could never be photocopied. Right. And I just put it on my desk cause I had to sit with it for a while. I just thought, what does this mean? Like, Man Ray hates photography. And so I started reading the entire, archive, the Hollywood Album archive as I was going through it. And he was very adamant that he hated photography and he was only doing it to make a living. So what he really wanted to do was paint.
I thought you were going to say direct.
But. No, right. That's why he came to Hollywood. No, he wanted to paint.
Yeah.
And I, you know, to this day, I haven't been able to find a reproduction of one of his paintings. So I think maybe I Googled it once and they're not that memorable or that good.
Okay.
It's disappointing.
This brings up complicated feelings in me because I'm one of these people who doesn't have necessarily like an ultra stark creative identity, like internally.
Yeah.
Like I thought, like at times I've been like, I'm a writer. And then I'm like, but I've mostly podcast and like, I like this. Like I love having these conversations. And then other times I'm like, I really like, you know, I like, I don't know.
But see,
politics or reading nonfiction, even though I'm not reading enough fiction, and I can get confused about it. And so I guess what I'm driving at is that I wonder if he ever made peace with it, or maybe it's the case that like he thought he wanted to paint, but he was really just a fucking great photographer.
But see, you're exactly where I was. This is what finding this out did to me. I just went into like, you know, I was spiraling out. I was like, what does any of this mean? You know, I was the same way, but I'm working here and this is what I do full time. And yes, this is my life, but also I'm also trying to be a writer too. What does this mean?
Yeah. I mean, look at me. I just got like a puppy. I'm like, I need an emotional support animal.
Bring him out. We need him right now. Just to hear the story.
But something to cuddle while I try to figure out my life.
So while he was here, he tried to exhibit his artwork. And he did. He did a couple different shows. And it was so sad. You watched him from, you know, he was here for 10 years. So from day one, being very excited and hopeful, right? We're on a new coast. He's also thinks California is gorgeous. He buys a car. He's in love with the car. He meets a woman. He's in love with her.
He kind of likes the woman.
Yeah, right. The woman's okay, but the car. It's funny enough, the car comes up way more than she does.
Really?
Yeah.
It's very California. Like, right? You know.
He does a lot of road trips up north. And he's really blown away by Hollywood, too. He thinks he goes to this one bar.
What year is this? Like, what time period?
This is it's World War II, so 1944. I don't know.
So that's a good time to be here.
Yeah.
At least in my brain.
Right. Well, yeah.
Not like super overpopulated, but like kind of golden age. And then post-war, like that's like the height of the American empire.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And he's, you can definitely feel that here. Right. But he's not getting any ground in selling his artwork. He at one point writes, if New York is 40 years behind Europe, Los Angeles is 40 years behind New York. Like nobody's willing to pay him for the work that he's showing. And he gets very discouraged. And it's really sad watching him go through this, because by the end of it, he decides to pack up and go back to Europe. And he doesn't like explicitly say, I failed as a painter. But then later I was reading his sort of like essays that he's written. And he's saying how he has always thought of himself as a photographer. That was always going to be his medium. And I'm like, I know better, dude.
Yeah, you can run, but you can't hide, man, Ray. But you know what? But what it says to me is that like, maybe some people have just this very, very, very clear sense of who they are. But identity is slippery. Like one sense of oneself, one sense of other people, like, you know, these things are not fixed.
Totally, totally. And I think part of it too is what was his life's work, which was photography, right? That's what he did to make a living, and he was good at it, and that's what we know him for. And that's really what stuck, like hit me hard from what I learned from it, was that if I continued working at the Getty full time, 50 hours a week, not having time for anything else, that was going to be my life's work. I was going to archive things beautifully. That's what I was going to be remembered for. And so I had to throw in the towel and leave.
And then what'd you do?
Moved out of my apartment because I had no money.
Okay. And so now you're homeless. And
so then I was bouncing around with my husband. And I took out some more loans to go to graduate school at UCR, Palm Desert. And
Todd Goldberg? Working.
Yes, yes.
Okay,
yes.
I've had him in here.
Yeah, he's great. He's hilarious. He's
everyone says, yeah. I mean, like for novelists and like, you know, like MFA directors, like they're rarely like that funny.
Right? He's one of the good Todds.
Yeah. I'm one of the good Brads, and Todd, you are one of the good Todds.
Yes.
We were in a rare fraternity of men.
And it was great. I started working part-time at the Last Bookstore.
Okay.
Doing events.
And that's a cool bookstore for people who are
Isn't
not from
great?
Los Angeles. It's downtown. It's huge,
mm-hmm.
like square footage wise.
Yes, it's huge. I think it's definitely the biggest used and new bookstore in Southern California.
Okay.
And what's neat about it is that Josh Spencer, who joined forces with a group of artists to sort of create the look of it, right? There's a book tunnel. There's artist studios upstairs that you can go and look at their work. It's a very sort of eclectic place.
It's funky.
Right? Yeah, it's really cool. There's nothing else like it out here. And I had a lot of fun there too. But the graduate program was great. I started writing. As soon as I left the Getty, actually, I wrote the first draft of Catalina.
How quickly?
Probably 2 months.
No
but
shit.
It was a novella. It was like 60 pages long.
Okay.
And I was like, maybe this is garbage. I don't know. But as soon as I started that program, I let Mary Otis see it. And she thought, oh, you should keep going. And I was like, okay.
Okay.
So
that's
I
all you need
on that
sometimes.
My entire UCR career. That's what I did.
What is your routine?
When I'm working, my routine is I usually will have a playlist that I associate with the world that the book's taking place in. So Catalina had one song in particular that I listened to every single time I sat down to write, just to sort of get myself prepared and get into the atmosphere in the world. And I looked at it when the book published, and I had listened to it like 674 times.
Interesting.
Yeah.
No, but that I did the same, a similar thing with my novel, where I just listened to the same songs over and over again, just as a way to re-enter the mood.
Definitely. I think it works. It's sort of like, it's a nice way to trick your brain, right? Mm-hmm. To get you right back in there. It's sort of like training it. I don't listen to those songs outside of working on the book. It's explicitly for that world.
Is there any music about Catalina, or was it just stuff that for you evoked emotion?
Evoked the emotion.
But there's not like a song called Catalina.
No.
Okay.
No, nothing like that. No, it was all to evoke emotion and atmosphere, which was fun because, well, fun for me because the book is all, you know, there's lots of drugs and alcohol and sex, and it's a fun book to write. But, you know, for my husband, he'd come home and I'm like smoking cigarettes outside and he's like, you don't smoke. What's happening? You know,
you're like, I'm in character. Leave me alone.
I'm method writing right now. You know,
you really did. You started smoking just to get into the book.
If I was having like a, you know, if I'm writing a specific scene that's very atmospheric and emotional, sometimes, yeah, I'll have gone and bought a pack of cigarettes and I'm having a martini.
Were
something.
You ever a smoker? Or this?
Yes, when I was younger,
I was.
It's not completely out of character.
Okay. So you had some experience.
Yes, I've had some. I'm not like learning which end to light or something like that. No.
That's cool. And then drugs and stuff. Like, did you have crazy periods in your life where you did a lot of drugs to inform those scenes?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't doing them when I was, you know, a teenager and thinking like, I'm doing these because later I'm going to write a book about this.
Field research. It's field research, Mom. I promise.
I'm telling you right now at 14, I know I'm going to be a writer in 10 years. So like,
you think I'm a fuck up. This is all part of my education.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think every drug that's in that book I've dabbled in.
Yeah.
Is that the gentlemanly way to say
that? That is. Or gentlewomanly?
Gentlewoman.
But did you have, like, you know, in terms of your creative sensibility or, like, your sense of self, like, how do you rate drug experiences? Like, I ask people on this show about this all the time. It's, like, one of these fixations of mine.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you. Like, in terms of forming who you are, your decision to be a creative person and to live your life creatively, I guess the kinds of creative choices that you make in your work, just all the decisions that go into like forming a person, an adult person. Do you think that it could have happened independent of those experiences? Like how closely related to them are you?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, there's a lot of different experiences that have probably formed who I am, and you know, I'll be writing books about them till I die. But I think, the drugs and the alcohol probably make up at least a small percentage, right? I mean, they have to. I come from a family that partakes in drugs and alcohol. So
is it bohemian? Like
bohemian, I guess, is sort of a word. I guess if we still use that word.
I use it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I guess it's sort of bohemian lifestyle. Although I will say that there's always the danger of going overboard, right? I know people who... there's dabbling and then there's drug addiction.
Right? Sure. Yeah.
And then there's alcoholism.
Of course.
And it's a dangerous, dangerous line. And I think in my youth, I've crossed over. So I know my limits now as an adult. I know which liquors not to mix and right. I know which drugs to stay away from and what parties not to go to and stuff like that. And they do inform my work mostly as a way of, sort of like a Bildung Roman sort of way, right? Like I traveled that road to get to where I am today. So it's reflected in Catalina. But
plus it's just fun to write about that
stuff.
It is
fun to write about, especially because Catalina is the first person. So whenever Elsa takes drugs, it's fun. It's just fun to, I know what it's like, you know.
You know, this makes me think of Lost, because, you know, to incorporating everything that we've been talking about, or a lot of what we've been talking about is, you know, Los Angeles as a place where there is this kind of subterranean or subsurface darkness, as this place that presents, or at least so often presents so beautifully, but, you know, there's a lot of pain underneath. And then there's also, you know, it's also associated with plenty of drug use and debauchery.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, like, Los Angeles is not like New York. Like, everywhere, like, the bars close at 2. You know, like, I it's not a place. I mean, like, and it's hard to, you have
it
to drive around.
It is a Puritan sort of place also, right?
It's weird. It's not like Chicago where people are out, like, boozing. And, like, they are, you know, you get a slice on the way home at 4 a.m. Like,
No.
Los Angeles, it's sort of like, do you want to go to this, like, apartment party? And then you, like, Uber home at 1. And, you know, it's not.
Yes.
I guess there are, I mean, maybe I just didn't go to the right parties.
No. I was thinking of the right word for it. Functional. We're all, like, I feel like everyone in Los Angeles proper is probably very functional partiers, right?
And people,
like,
and they, you know, you still exercise, you get your, you get your green juice.
Actually, I think a couple nights ago I went to Musso and Frank's, had some martinis, and then the next morning I was out hiking in the morning, and I was like, do I taste gin? And then I was like, oh yeah, no, this is very Southern California,
right?
Or Los Angeles, right?
You got to have it all.
Have it all.
See, but I also, because I can get into conversations where I start to defend vanity as, like, something that is not necessarily all negative. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like vanity can be, have sort of a saving quality. And it could be tied at its best to a form of self-respect. Like, it is good to take care of yourself.
Yeah. Yes.
And, like,
yes.
People are like, who are like, oh, you know, it's just so vain if you're, like, you know, eating good food or drinking a juice or something. It's like, hey, you know, like,
I'm living life.
I'm trying not to die, you know?
Well, at this point I feel, you know, back to the tire fire, like, we have so few things right now.
They give you a sense of control.
That's give you a sense of control. Also, this goes back to what we're talking about, beauty and living in its place. I think a lot of times people here drink to the extent that they drink or dabble in drugs because they're under pressure 72 hours out of the week, right? Actually, all the time we feel the pressure here to be not just perfect, but to live the fantasy, to make our dreams come true, right? Like, if not here, where? Where else do dreams come true if not Los Angeles? I don't know. I mean, that's what this place is supposed to be.
Like, I'm starting to think it's like Vancouver or
it might be
Wellington.
But that you know, that's the reason why when I have friends come here and then they come to Hollywood and they get that disappointed look on their face. I'm like, yes, you thought your dreams would come, you know, they would come true if you came here, but it's just like any other place, right?
And how much of a role do you think luck plays in life? Because you, like, well, there's all these stories. Some of them are apocryphal. Some of them are actually true, but you hear them a lot.
Yeah.
They've become part of the mythology of this place, particularly as it, you know, as it pertains to, like, entertainment culture.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, was it Rita Hayworth or who was the actress who was at Schwab's drugstore and, like, got discovered or...
oh God, probably like 50% of them. Right?
Yeah. But I mean, like, there's a famous one. I don't think it was Rita Hayworth.
It wasn't Marilyn Monroe, right? Wasn't she sort of discovered too?
But it's always like happenstance. Like Charlize Theron, I know.
God, have you seen her in person? She's another one of those where you're just like,
she's like
Jesus
6 feet tall.
Christ.
Yeah.
I know. I've always been like, well, I'm 6 feet tall. I'm just broad. And then I saw her and I was like, we have the same body type. Damn it. You're just beautiful.
Yeah. Don't sell yourself short. But she is, you know, she's stunning. But also, like, I find her sort of intimidating. Like, you don't fuck with her.
No, God, no.
Like, not because of anything she says or does, like, in when you're in her presence, but just, like, that's the vibe. It's like, she could kill me.
I saw her and I was like, would you hold me?
Yeah, right. For you, it's like,
make
yes.
Make me feel little.
Yeah. But, she, I want to say the story is that she was at the post office and was, like, having a shit day and, like, you know, or something, and, like, was, like, dressing down the person in line or something. And there was, like, an agent there. He was like, I need to get it. You know,
that's the story. Yeah. Wow. I've never heard that.
The rest is history, but it's like, she went to the post office, you know? And so I'm always thinking, like, God, like, if she doesn't go there that day, who knows what happens.
Right. Yeah. But that's part of the magic of this place, right? That could happen at any moment, you know? To answer your question about luck, I think it has a lot to do with it. I think I do believe in luck. I didn't for the longest time. I just thought there was people who tried really hard and didn't see results, and some people that did. And then I realized, oh no, that's actually luck. Some people are just lucky. You know, you're in the right place at the right time.
So it's like, I think I agree, but I think in terms of the actual work and the way you conduct yourself in life, you kind of have to pretend that it doesn't exist.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can't just sit back and hope luck will choose you or something.
I'm just going to keep going to the post office.
Right.
Until somebody finally taps me on the shoulder.
I think that's part of the reason why I didn't want to believe in luck is because it basically means we have no control. Right. And I think as writers, we want to control everything. That's why we're world building. Right. We
need
to control these characters and play God. You tell me there's something out there that's going to basically mean I'm going to succeed or not. I don't want to believe that that exists, but now, you know, I have a book out there and I realize I have a lot to thank because of luck.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about it. So you wrote this book.
Mm-hmm.
You had Mary Otis tell you to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
You had Todd Goldberg like crack jokes while you were like neurotically trying to finish this manuscript for comic relief.
Yeah.
But you have a workshop environment. I'm sure you met other writers, and that's its own kind of like support.
Yeah,
and it's good.
Yeah.
You know, if nothing else, just to meet other crazy people.
Yes.
Who are interested in doing this stuff.
Yes.
That was my MFA experience mostly. It was just like, oh, okay. So like there are other people. You don't necessarily meet them.
As writers, we work by ourselves, right?
Right.
So it's nice and also very stressful to see everybody. I mean, mine was a low residency program. So it's hard to not see anybody for 3 months and then you're all living together for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
That's a little intense.
In the desert.
I mean, in a beautiful hotel, which makes things easier, but also it's, you know, you have to be on for 2 weeks. And I, you know, for 3 months was
not
working
on.
In my underwear, you know? So it's just like, it's difficult. It's a difficult switch.
Yeah. Well, but it gives you some structure, mm-hmm. and it also gives you deadlines and mm-hmm. accountability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then like how many drafts did you go through, and then talk us through how you went from there to being represented? I'm assuming you're represented,
mm-hmm.
and then finding a home for the book, and like, and how did luck factor in?
Yeah. So I probably rewrote that book. I would say that the MFA program worked really well in giving me permission to, I guess, focus on that book. So I went in with it as a novella, right? It was 60 pages. And I just kept, I was working with Mary Otis, Mark Haskell Smith, and Todd. Those were the three people I worked with. And they just kept telling me, build this out. Like, why is this person doing this? Focus on these characters. And I really got to know each character, not just the main character, all of them. And I just kept writing scenes, right? And sort of was pulling it apart. So I didn't really have like a first draft in probably my last couple quarters there.
Just so I'm clear, like you were writing scenes, you didn't mm-hmm. necessarily know exactly where they fit into the superstructure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You didn't have some like grand outline.
Well, funny enough, so I originally wanted to write sort of a retelling of Jean Reese's Good Morning Midnight,
okay.
which came out almost 100 years ago now. And I wanted it, so I sort of always knew beginning, middle, and end.
But by the way, Jean Reese,
yeah.
Hated writing.
Did she?
No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, God.
She really just wanted to, needlepoint. But
actually, that's pretty close. I think she just wanted to be happily married. But that just never happened, so she wrote instead.
I think, sometimes I think about this, there are certain like writers I feel like, I don't know, I can, as a guy who has two kids and like this really crazy family life and all these demands, I'm sometimes like, wow, they're creative people where it's like their art is their children. And like, they get to focus all that human energy into the creation of it.
That's a lot of pressure on those kids though.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Don't listen to this, children. No, but I think that, as a function of human energy.
Yes.
You know, my energy is by necessity more diffuse just because I got all these different things to tend to.
Yeah, that's good.
And it's great. You know, I'm not complaining at all, but it's hard not to sometimes be like, wow, if I could just channel all of this.
Into those kids?
Or into if I actually paid attention to my children, imagine what kind of father I could be.
Oh, you mean like if you focused all of that into
creative work. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you'd be neurotic about that one thing. I mean, that's what happened to me. I put so much pressure on myself to write this book and get it published that if it hadn't happened, I don't know what I would have done.
Yeah, like your identity is like tied to it.
Oh, completely. Like,
I
still tied to it. And
sure.
It's difficult having it out there now because, you know, I wasn't prepared to have my identity tied to a book and have that book be on Goodreads, you know?
Like, yeah.
All of a sudden I'm like, well, you're giving me 2 stars?
Yeah, but it's weird. That's the thing. It's like there's a big weird emotional hiccup that happens in between. Like there's acquisition.
Yes.
There's like the ecstasy of creation, especially
yes.
when it's going well,
yeah, yeah.
which is really the...
That's great.
That's the best part.
That's the drug, right?
But I think in hindsight, you look back and you're like, that was the best part.
Yeah, totally.
And then then you get the agent and you're like, somebody loves me. And then you get a publisher and it's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And then it's like pub day and the things, or you get your galley.
There's all these
little moments emotionally where you're watching it be birthed.
Yeah.
And then it goes out into the world. And I think sometimes it can be anticlimactic or it can be confusing.
Both of those things I think are true. Yeah. That's exactly right. I mean, especially because I worked on it for 5 years before it was actually birthed into the world.
Uh-huh.
And the last three were a lot of just me waiting And that's a long time to be waiting to birth something.
Sure.
You know, you just have this one date focused, like hyper-focused on that.
Did you try to work on your next book while, like, during that time?
Yes, I did. But I wrote one draft, and then, you know, my editor was like, let's not work on this until Catalina's out. And I was like, well, then what do I do? So I was, you know, writing essays and stuff like that and trying to keep myself, you know, calm until the book came out. And then the book came out, and it wasn't that it was anticlimactic, because I got on a lot of nice press and stuff. It just felt... It wasn't what I thought it was going to be, I guess. I don't know what I thought it was going to be.
I think that, and it's a hard thing to language, you know, where you're like, what did I think it was going to be? And what is this? And there's just a lot tied to it. And, it's emotional.
Yes. I think that's exactly right.
You put a lot into it to make a book and to spend 5 years laboring and to, you know,
telling yourself, I'm going to just be as honest as possible, which was why I think a lot of the labels shocked me. Cause, not that they were, you know, shocking labels or something like that, noir and stuff like that, but that so quickly something I could work on for 5 years could be whittled down to one box, you know, and that was a little abrasive, I guess, for me to come to terms with.
And you just, it's not yours anymore.
Yeah. Right. That's another thing, right?
I always used to liken it. I mean, you know, not to keep bringing things back to kids, but I always likened it to like sending your kid off to school for the first time and just hoping it doesn't get its ass kicked on the playground.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
Be nice to
me. Just wringing your hands at home, refreshing, you know,
that's basically
your emails to see if the principal's going to email you and let you know,
right.
You know,
yeah,
that's
sorry.
First 4 weeks, just me being like, you know, checking my Google alerts. What's happening now?
Insane. Is it weird that I have a Google alert set for this? But I need to know.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about luck, though. I didn't hear the story of how...
Oh, the agent and stuff.
Yeah.
So I was lucky in that I landed an agent while I was in the program. Mm. Dara Hyde is my agent at Hill Nadell, and she is one of the guest faculty that Todd has visit.
Got it.
And how UCR works is you have... I guess whoever is graduating that senior class, Todd will have an agent and an editor read your work, and they'll give you feedback. That's not how I got my agent, actually. I had known her before because of my job at the last bookstore.
Oh, okay.
So do you need me to pause for that?
No, it's okay. Fine. It's just surveillance.
Surveillance. Just the eye in the sky. So I knew Dara from working at the last bookstore. But I didn't want to send her my manuscript because I thought, you know, I was so green at this point. I thought, I don't want to risk my professional position at the last bookstore with this agent by giving her my manuscript, right? Like that could complicate things with my boss and stuff. So I was sending my manuscript out to all these different agents, people that Mark and Todd had recommended to me, and mostly not hearing anything or hearing, you know, no, thank you. I'll be cheering for you from the sideline.
Like that, those rejection letters that like the first paragraphs, like this, the voice in this is like, you have an incredible voice. And
that said, I'm sad
to report that, like, I just don't feel like I'm, and you're just like, fuck.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I was really getting my ass handed to me. A lot of those emails too. And it was, because my identity was so wrapped up in this book and I had worked on it so hard for the couple years that I was in grad school that I really felt, you know, Mark and Todd were so excited about it. And a lot of the students were too, that I kind of felt this pressure of wanting to prove to them that they had that on the right horse, I guess, sort of thing. So I was just feeling a lot of pressure. Not to mention I had quit my job and I had, you know, relocated us to Crenshaw at this point and was just like, I want my husband not to divorce me.
It's always a positive. Don't blow up your most important relationship.
Yeah, you know, he's supported me through all this. And then Dara and I were talking at residency and she said, I've heard such great things about your manuscript. Why haven't you sent it to me? And I explained to her that I didn't want to compromise our business relationship. And she was like, no, I'm completely capable of rejecting you if this doesn't work out and we can still work together at the last bookstore. And I was like, oh, okay.
Oh, I wish I would have known.
How lovely.
Yeah,
great.
Right.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah.
So I sent it to her. And you know, a few months went by and I sort of forgot about it. And then she reached out and said, let's work on this together, which was great. Because I wasn't happy with the ending. What happened was during the program, because I got to know the characters, I decided I didn't want the original ending. Because I sort of fell in love with Elsa and I wanted something nicer to happen to her.
Yeah, okay.
The ending of Jean Reese books are not happy, basically. Yeah. So I didn't want that to happen for Elsa. So I was really trying to work around the ending that was meant to be, I think. So Dara and I worked together on the book for about 6 months, I think, before we went to submission.
That's like, how substantive were the changes? Mostly focused on the end?
Completely focused on the end. I think an agent does it. A lot of the stuff that they do is really get the manuscript in fighting shape so you don't embarrass yourself.
A good agent. Reads it.
Yeah, good agent, right? Yeah. And she was really invested in the characters too. So she wanted to have the book feel like the ending was a true product of where the character started and where, you know, they should end up. So we worked on that together. And then we went into submission. And that was, it's such a weird world, right? Because you're working by yourself, you're waiting. And then there's these moments that are so fast, like submission. Just all of a sudden you're in submission. 3 weeks go by, the book sold.
Yeah, it took right? 3 weeks.
I think so, yeah.
That's pretty quick. Weeks.
Yeah, it was pretty fast. And Daphne and I had done a phone call conversation to see if we would work well together or not. And she liked me, I liked her, and I don't know, but we just clicked.
The rest is history.
I didn't want to say that, but yeah, the rest is history. Yeah.
That's very exciting. So what did you do when you found out that the book had sold? How did you get that information? How did you get that news?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I'll remember it forever. It's so silly to say that, but I swim at the Rose Bowl Aquatic Center and I walked out, I got into the car. I knew I was in submission. I had been checking my phone probably, every 4 minutes. Refreshing my email,
sure,
seeing if I got any phone calls from Dara, and I had missed a phone call. And
see, this
I
is
know,
what
right?
If the good news comes by phone, bad news comes by email.
Yeah, totally.
They don't want to call you and be like, I'm so sorry.
Right? we're gonna, yeah. Yeah. And I knew that, Dara was she really wanted that she had some things in the works. We had talked earlier in the week, and different people were interested, so she was going to try to close out by the end of the week. So she said, call me back. I have some news. So I called her back and I sat in the parking lot. And her husband answered the phone. It was her birthday. And when she came onto the phone, she said, you gave me the best birthday present ever. And I was like, what is it? What did I get you? And she said a 2-book, deal, an advanced. Yeah. 2-book deal.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's a show of faith.
Yeah. I think I started crying. I remember starting to cry.
like what kind of tears are we talking? Like full body sobs or just like a couple of trickles?
I tried to act really professional on the phone call with her, and I sort of blacked out, I think, because I don't remember the rest of the phone call. And then I hung up, and then I put on some music, punched out in the car. Everyone, I'm sure, walking by was like, what is going on in that car right now? And then I called my husband and ugly cried on the phone.
That's fantastic.
Yeah,
I love those
wonderful
stories.
Really wonderful.
Yeah.
And then for the rest of the day, I think I got home and I just kept listening to music and sliding around on the floor in my socks, dancing.
Yes.
Like that. I mean, you couldn't.
It was like Tom Cruise in Risky Business.
Yeah,
singing into a trophy, essentially.
Yes. Yes. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Wow.
It was
music
really
is big for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, especially for, special moments.
Yeah.
Because now whenever I listen to those songs that I had on that day, I'm just
searching my mind, trying to think of what song to play at the end of this interview. I want to mark this moment for you. I know it's
better.
I know it's a big deal.
But it's great because now, I get to focus on a second book now, which is fun.
I was just going to ask you, what's going on with it? Do we have any hints?
Yes. Well, it's funny because, I said I was a method writer, and if I ever had the funds to do a book somewhere fancier than Catalina, I would do that. So my second book, after doing some prolonged research around the globe. No.
Where do I want to go?
It's just been...
The novel is called Boondoggle.
My year abroad. No, I did... I decided the second book is going to take place in Rome and Puglia.
Oh.
So I've gone there twice.
Oh, good for you.
Thank you. Yeah.
And good trips?
Yeah, great trip. Well, the first time... I first thought the book would take place in Oxford, England. And then I thought maybe Portugal. So I checked those places out first. And they didn't work. And then I went to Rome and I thought, actually, this could really work. But I went in October.
Okay. So what's it about? Can you give us any hints?
Yes. I'll tell you, it's about, an older woman, who's going through perimenopause. Hence why I wanted it to be somewhere very hot and,
like hot flashes.
Rome. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if I want to give it away. No, I'll tell you. I mean, my editor hasn't even told me if she likes this, so this could end up completely out. But
that's
right
fine.
Now,
that's
what
fine.
I want it to be about is an older woman who seduces a younger boy, an Italian boy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
It sounds fun, right?
Sounds fantastic.
It'll be just as fun and devastating as Catalina.
Okay. Good.
I promise.
You're going to have to fix the end.
Less drugs, though. Yeah.
Less drugs?
Less,
well, you never know.
Less drugs, yeah. Like right now.
Perimenopause. And,
a lot of Negronis happening in it right now.
That's good.
So.
That's good. And you said earlier, you know, what else I want to ask you before I forget is your tattoo. Whenever I have writers in the show who have visible tattoos, I'm always like, what's the story?
No. Oh.
So what do you have a tattoo on, like the underside of your wrist? And it says, what does it say?
It says Vaja in Slovak. It means twin sister. I have a twin sister.
Oh, you do?
Yes. She has one. We're fraternal. So hers is on the other arm going the other direction.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I asked.
Yeah. We're complete opposites. She's like a foot shorter than me and a scientist.
My sister, my little sister just had fraternal twin girls.
Oh, really?
They're going to turn a year old in June.
Born at Cedars-Sinai?
No, they're in the Midwest.
I was like, that would have been very cool.
We're going to get them tattooed tomorrow. Just in keeping. But and so you have one sister?
I have also a little sister and a little brother.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Four kids.
Yes.
In a bohemian Hollywood family.
In a bohemian, yep, yeah.
Just living all over the... and you said, you have enough material to write about for the rest of your life. Were you speaking generally in the way that writers talk? Or like, do you really have like big events that you're going to be mining, you think?
I mean, yes. I think what I will probably be mining my entire career will be womanhood, probably, which I think is a very deep well.
I'm going to be mining that too, yeah. Just so you know.
I think we do a lot of that. You know, identity is a big one too.
Yeah.
I love writing about Los Angeles. So even though this next book takes place in Rome, my character's from Hollywood and she's from a Hollywood family.
Uh-huh.
And
people like reading about that stuff.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, it's mythology. I mean, like it travels.
Yeah. And it's all about identity here. Right. And that's a universal thing, you know? So, and I already have a sort of idea for a third and a fourth book.
Oh.
I know.
Okay. I'm not going to make you go over that. I'll let you have some privacy.
No, they're not ready to be talked about yet. They're back there.
What is the ending of your fourth book?
No, I don't know. I just start crying. Bring the puppy back.
Yeah, we're going to get the puppy out for some emotional support. I think we've done We've done enough damage. She's traumatized. Like, it sounds like she's having fun, but I can tell you there's just a haunted...
She's crying.
There's a haunted look in her eyes. It's been great to meet you,
and I
appreciate
me.
You coming over here to talk to me. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, there you have it. That's Liska Jacobs. Her novel is called Catalina. It is available now from MCD FSG. Catalina by Liska Jacobs. Go get your copy. You can find Liska online. She's all over the place. She's got a website. It's called LiskaJacobs.com. Her website is called LiskaJacobs.com. She's on Tumblr. She's on Facebook. Her Twitter handle is at Liska Jacobs, LISKA. And she's got an Instagram. Track her down online. Liska Jacobs Catalina. Thanks to Kill Rockstars for the music. Be sure to check out killrockstars.com. The music at the very top of the show during the Patreon part. That's the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. Check them out when you're down in New Orleans in the French Quarter. I like them. Don't forget about the app, the Other People app. It's free. It's the best way to listen. Go get the app wherever apps are available. It's free. The Other People app. If you want to email me, the address is letters@otherppl.com. If you want to support the show, it's patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod. So, what can I tell you? What can I tell you about Twiggy? She's a little vocal, nothing major. Oh, you know what I forgot to mention is that she arrived in our home with some sort of gastrointestinal parasite, which I was not aware of, and which is not entirely uncommon for large rescue litters from, a disadvantaged situation or a rough situation. So I took her out in the pre-dawn hours of Sunday morning. So we bring the dog home on Saturday afternoon, early, early Sunday morning. I'm in the backyard with her. It's still dark outside. And, I'm putting her in the lawn so she can go to the bathroom, and she poops. And I realized when I picked her up that there was something wrong with her... her backside. She had a prolapse situation. I had to go to the vet at like 7 a.m. I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritty details, but basically it was related to this parasite. She's on medication now. There have been no subsequent incidences of prolapse. Do you know what a prolapse is? Maybe look that up.